Setting the Record Straight, Chuck Coughlin, on breadboxmedia.com. If you're looking at our webpage right now, you see there's an opportunity to become a subscriber for $9.99 a month. One of the things you'll get for that is access to a library, and it's a vast library, of podcasts created by our team of remarkably artistic and intelligent contributors, and a few lesser folk like myself. This podcast is, of course, about the hidden history of the English Protestant Reformation. Why is it hidden? Well, I think it's the product of incredible competitiveness, hostility, and actually wars, decades of wars. There was certainly a war of words between the Catholic countries of Spain and France and England once Henry VIII decided to break with the Pope and declare himself the head of his church, the English Catholic Church. It was propaganda. There's a difference between history and propaganda. Maybe there's a little propaganda in all of history, though, because we select the most comfortable things to say. But sometimes it's entirely altered. And that's certainly the case with the popularly accepted history of the Roman Catholic Church in England. What most people believe to be true about that period is a huge historical lie. The real history is hidden. Rather teach and learn the real English history of that period. Instead, there's a commonly accepted myth that the Anglican Church was founded on an ancient apostolic church that existed in Britain for 600 years before the arrival of St. Augustine of Canterbury. My British friends often say that we're Catholic too, we're just not Roman Catholic. The theory is that the English Church was always Catholic, but in the 16th century, under Henry VIII, it was reformed. Since King Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church to found the Church of England, you'd think that Anglicans would never claim to be Catholic, but they do. The popular idea is that jolly old King Henry VIII saw that monasteries were full of fat old monks, and he went through and tidied things up a bit. The church had become fat, old, and corrupt, and Henry and his children, Edward, and then Elizabeth, straightened things out, streamlined a few things, and got everything shipshape again. Well, this is not only a complete whitewash of the depredations, iconoclasm, and wholesale destruction of the Catholic Church, but is also a misreading of English Catholic history. Along with this view of the English Reformation is a strange idea that the Church in England was from the beginning separate from Rome, and that only in the Middle Ages onward was it under Rome's thumb. A good number of Anglicans have bought into an alternative history, not only believing the old tale that Joseph of Arimathea brought Catholicism to the British Isles, but there was also an ancient link between the Celtic people and the Copts of Egypt. They find scraps of evidence, like some ancient carvings in Ireland, which seem similar to church art in Egypt. The idea that the church in England grew out of links that were independent of Roman authority suits Anglicans, because they like to imagine that there are three ancient apostolic church: Rome, the Orthodox, and themselves. The Celtic-Coptic theory enables them to sustain this myth. It also helps them to defend their continued independence from Roman authority. The Anglican argument goes like this: we're descendants of the first British Christians. They existed happily for 600 years independent of Rome, and are simply part of that same stream of ancient apostolic Christianity. Well, unfortunately, the idea that Celtic Christianity sprang up on its own independent of Rome just doesn't fit the facts. At the time that Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries and demolished many of the buildings, smashed a great legacy of beautiful sculpture that had evolved in England, beautiful religious sculpture, Catholic monks arrived early in England and labored for 1,100 years, taking marshy wastelands, laboring for centuries to modify the landscape into the beautiful, even gorgeous aspect of the English countryside that we all know from pictures, or if we're lucky, having been there. The monks, the motto was prayer and work, ora et labora. And they worked hard. Then, suddenly, in the 1500s, Henry VIII confiscated it all. The monastery lands comprised one-fifth of the land area of England. Henry VIII took all this and distributed it among his nobles, some of them creating great manor houses out of the monasteries. And the cathedral ruins that we see, like Tintern Abbey, often said to be so romantic, they're the product of his order that those places be destroyed. The stained glass windows smashed, the roofs removed. We do have clear evidence that Christianity in Britain was from the first Roman Catholicism. To pin it down, we have to look at what happened in the Roman Empire the first decades after the death of Christ. Just 10 years after Jesus' crucifixion, the Emperor Claudius of Rome successfully invaded Britain. Over the next 350 years, the Romans established a thriving colony. The colony occupied virtually the whole land area of Britain. With the Roman armies came Roman religions, and one of the religions was the new religion of Catholicism. The first Christians in Britain, therefore, were Roman Catholics. Catholic inscriptions found on crude Roman pottery in Britain dating from this period suggest that the first Catholics were poor people, probably Roman soldiers or slaves even. The documentary evidence comes from Tertullian and Origen, both writing in the 2nd century. That they knew of the Catholic Church in Britain shows that it was sufficiently well-founded, large enough and connected enough with the rest of the Catholic Church, that Catholics in North Africa knew of it and wrote about it. By the 3rd and 4th century, the evidence for Roman Catholicism in Britain is overwhelming. The first British martyr was St. Alban. He was killed for his faith, for his Catholic faith, in 304 AD. 304, early. There must have been a well-established hierarchy because it's recorded that the bishops of London, York, and Lincoln attended the Council of Arles in 314. The British bishops were also present at the Council of Rimini in 359. You know what you find everywhere in Britain? Archaeological evidence for Roman Catholicism. There's Cairo monograms scratched in 3rd century pottery, a ceramic plaque with the Paternoster inscribed on it, mosaic floors with Catholic symbols, and even an image of Christ. From that period are remains of Catholic chapels, Romano-British Catholic burial sites, and a fantastic discovery in 1975 of a 4th century silver chalice with Catholic markings, showing that the Mass was not only celebrated in Roman Britain, but celebrated in a quite sumptuous style. During the first 350 years, the British Catholics were Roman. We know they converted some of the locals. But what happened after the Romans withdrew from Britain? That was around 410 AD. Did the British Church suddenly declare independence of Roman authority? Is this when the independent Celtic Church was established? Well, that's not the case. After the departure of the Roman legions in the early 400s, the British Catholics relied even more on their Roman church contacts. This is the time of the Pelagian heresy. And in 429, a British deacon appealed to the Pope for help to combat it. Pope Celestine commissioned Saint-Germain of Auxerre to go on a mission to Britain. Saint-Germain was accompanied by no less than St. Patrick. St. Patrick stayed there and established seminaries, and revisited Britain in 447 to consolidate his work. Well, this is a pretty clear example, not only of Rome asserting authority in Britain, but also of the British Church asking for that authority. Around 450, the Saxons started to invade a weakened Britain, and for the next 150 years, the pagan Saxons persecuted the Catholics in Britain. The persecuted Catholic minority fled west to Cornwall, Wales, and Ireland, and south to Brittany and France. It was only during this 150 years that the Celtic Church existed in isolation from the authority structures of Rome. Even then, the missionary endeavors to Ireland continued from Roman origins and not from Coptic Egypt. St. Patrick, the great apostle of Ireland, was born in Scotland of noble Roman parents. His mother was a relative of the great Saint Martin of Tours. His origin and training didn't come out of nowhere. It was all from the Roman Catholic Church. Patrick's mission was actually commissioned by that same Pope Celestine. When he went to Ireland in 433, he didn't discover an ancient Celtic church. Oh no, what he came up against was bands of bloodthirsty druids who needed converting. It is true that the Celtic Church, aided by Patrick, developed in relative isolation from Rome for about those 150 years. But in Britain, it was soon to be reconciled. In 5, St. Augustine of Canterbury arrived, 597. He arrived in the southeast of England. He was sent by Pope St. Gregory the Great. Eventually, his missionaries encountered missionaries of the Irish Church who had been evangelizing England from the north and west. When they met there, there were some differences of discipline. At the Synod of Wilby, 664, the matter was debated, and the Celtic contingent bound to the authority of St. Peter in the person of the Pope. You know what their king said? If he is Peter, I must agree with him, acknowledging the apostolic succession of the Pope. So that's the record we're trying to set straight today. The hidden history of Roman Catholicism in England. Was the Anglican Church founded on some pure, serene, and ancient apostolic church that existed in Britain for 600 years before the arrival of St. Augustine sent by Pope Gregory? Well, there's no evidence for that. No evidence at all. Instead, the British Church was started by Romans, converted the locals, and remained linked to Rome even after the legions departed from Britain. After that, the missionary efforts to the British Isles were Roman in origin. You know that 150 years that the Catholic Church was being persecuted? It was like the Catholic Church in China today. It existed underground, in isolation from the seat of authority. But just as soon as they had the opportunity to again to submit to St. Peter, they did so. So Henry VIII's suppression of the monasteries, he ordered the elimination of the colorful Roman Catholic vestments. He ordered the stripping of the altars, the seizing of their lands, and the persecution and martyrdom of thousands. These persecutions just weren't ordered by Henry VIII, but by his daughter Elizabeth, and it went on for generations. Elizabeth was especially hostile to Catholics, and ordered the tortures to be public and painful and slow as possible. Slow them down more. Find a way to slow them down more. There was more than just suppression, all because Henry wanted a divorce. You can say about Luther and Calvin that they proceeded from an idea, and conceptually intellectual idea. Henry just wanted a male heir. And he wanted a divorce. And had six wives. It's sort of peculiar that in ordering the seizure of the monasteries, he ordered the destruction of the Catholic art, the stained glass windows, smashing of statues, the burning of paintings. It may be that the greatest masterpieces that Britain ever produced were destroyed that way. The best art seems to be inspired by religion. It's not odd at all, is it? It's the best content, not style. But it's peculiar. Once he removed himself from the Roman Catholic Church, then he felt the desire to destroy the statues and the paintings, the great religious art. A man named David Warren wrote a essay for the Catholic Thing that arrived in my email box. And he said something that's interesting. He said, without faith, art is a monkey's game. Conversely, I suppose without art, religious ideas cannot be adequately expressed. This can be seen in all cultures, this departure from the commonplace, right in the midst of commonplace. Everywhere the divine is instinctively acknowledged in elevated language, in gesture, liturgy, which is art. Art is a vital part of religious expression. Maybe it's essential to it. It's more than mnemonic. The Last Supper itself is not merely remembered in the liturgical events of the Triduum, in the repetitions of the daily Mass. As the Catholic churches continue to teach, the real presence transcends the historical event. Yet the historical event remains true to it. These things continue to happen in a world that was altered by the coming of our Savior. The Stripping of the Altars is the title of a book by Eamon Duffy, which has now been in circulation for over a quarter century. It's a remarkable revisionist history of the English Reformation, which to my mind has grown in significance over this time. It challenges the myth and propaganda that has guided our thinking in the English-speaking realms and beyond them, wherever our influence has been felt. It's a variation on the pagan myth of Prometheus. Remember Prometheus? He stole the divine fire and put it at the service of his fellow man. And of course, what happened? He burned everything down. He had the fire without the control that the gods exercised upon him. Yes, the popularly believed history of the English Reformation is a myth. In this popular myth, the English Reformation is presented as a replacement for a tired and failing Catholic Church. And overturning it led to a kind of liberation, that the Protestant faith emerged as a rekindling, a maturing, a coming of age in a spiritual Magna Carta. Henceforth, we would no longer be captive to the authority of a dark and conniving priesthood, but free to read the scriptures for ourselves, to strip the churches of their encrusted decorations, to form our own judgments and write our own prayers. We all share in this history, going back to Henry VIII, and striding forward through the reigns of Edward VI and Elizabeth I, when the medieval order was turned upside down. And being a practicing Roman Catholic was a capital offense. If caught, you would be executed. What even Duffy showed for this generation, as for instance Philip Hughes for an earlier one, in the three volumes of his Reformation in England, was the evidence of a huge, enduring historical lie. The old order was robust to the eve of this revolution, which was imposed by force. The resistance to it from the people was profound, yet it failed in England as elsewhere under the violence of an emerging political power directing theology to its own ends. Liturgical destruction at every level, extending to the dissolution of monasteries, the smashing of images, the torching of medieval libraries, was necessary to the creation of a brave new world, in which the church was placed at the disposal of Caesar. The old order, based upon the Roman Catholic Church, was robust and vibrant right up to the eve of the revolution. So this is Chuck Coughlin again setting the record straight, to some small extent, on BreadboxMedia.com. Pax Christi.